This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They have lost out on their social interaction with other children. They have lost out on the health care that they got in school, the water sanitation support that they had in school.
That's Abhiyan Rani, UNICEF's Regional Education Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa, on how many adolescent young girls out of school face early marriage, early pregnancies, and child abuse. Details coming up. Also, the United Nations, African Union, U.S., Great Britain, and other foreign governments have condemned yesterday's attempted coup in Sudan. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In his recorded address to the UN General Assembly yesterday, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi repeatedly called for international assistance for African countries and international cooperation to enhance world peace. El-Sisi said there will be no stability in the Middle East without a just solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Ahmed Fatih, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the highlights of Egyptian president's address to the UN.
Egypt is an African country. It's in the northeast corner. It's a part of reality of the world we live in. As far as for President Sisi's request to increase aid to Africa, this is something that should be welcomed across the African continent. He spoke about the vaccine equity. He spoke about his country's attempt to establish a manufacturing facility so it can provide for its people and export to the brethren in the continent. Egypt is linked organically with the Sudan and the South Sudan and Ethiopia and the old Nile Basin countries. This is an organic linkage. The other part, I found that it was also echoing to other calls, but it's much needed for the African continent, was the issue of the debt relief. Debt is a major obstacle for development in Africa. Debt is a major factor in balance sheet, the deficit of the country. So releasing the debt together with the world, the IMF increased special withdrawal units totaling $600 billion for the least developed countries in the world. I think this can mitigate part of the damages that happen to the economy. So it is, all in all, it's a very pro-Africa, and I think it will be welcomed from different capitals, regardless of any political disagreement.
President Sisi used the address to emphasize the need to reach a legal binding agreement on the filling and operation of the Ethiopian Grand Renaissance Dam, hinting at the water poverty in Egypt and its potential threat to world peace. What's your take on that?
The issue of the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is an ongoing problem. Negotiations have been going for 10 years to reach a legally binding agreement. Till now, there is no conclusion of that agreement. Egypt and Sudan decided to go to the Security Council. We spoke about the outcome from the Security Council and the lack of political will and appetite to deal with water disputes because it's prevalent across the world. As far as Egypt and the Nile, there is a French phrase written by a French philosopher. He said, "Pas de Nil, pas de Egypte." No Nile, no Egypt. It has a single major source of water. That's the River Nile. River Nile does not originate in Egypt, but it originates in 9 different countries. From the Egyptian perspective, I see it as an existential threat. From the Ethiopian perspective, I see it, yes, they have absolute right for development and generating electricity. The only way to bridge between all the parties and to go back to the spirit of the African brethren is to engage in a win-win solution. You cannot cut the water, hypothetically, of course, speaking, from Egypt and the Sudan, engineering speaking. So the only way is that to have cooperation. There might be talk about cooperation, But translating this cooperation into a legally binding agreement, that's lacking political will from the Ethiopian side.
The U.S. is not relaunching peace talks between Israel and Palestinians. President Sisi called in his address for a just negotiated settlement leading to the two-state solution. What do you make of that?
My first impression, it's part of the rhetoric. There is nothing that changed the situation within the Palestinian factions and the Palestinian Authority. In Israel, they have a new unity government. Everybody is looking for how long and when they're going to reach the partisan disagreement. So it is not really on the Israeli side, it's not 100%. On the Palestinian side, Palestinians, we need to see new elections. There need to be a new generation. The current generation have been around for so long and they have reached a stagnant position. I would think there would be more transfer of power among the generation within the Palestinian factions. But it's all parties need to get their acts together. But the situation is not ready. Egypt has nothing else to say. They're trying with Hamas in Gaza. They're trying to increase the support for the reconstruction. They even put $500 million from their budget, which is in deficit already. But they realize that the Gaza problem affects their national security. It's right on their eastern border. It cannot be left unattended. All in all, I'm not expecting any major breakthroughs, at least for the end of this year.
That was Ahmed Fatih, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed Al-Shenawi. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, 18 months into the COVID-19 pandemic, schools for nearly 77 million students in six countries continue to be almost completely closed. They are Bangladesh, Kuwait, Panama, the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela. But tens of millions of students, including those in Africa, have an uneven access to schooling and to remote learning. UNICEF, expressing its concern for months of lost learning, is urging governments to reopen schools as soon as possible. Mavis Ochera in Juwaso, in the Ashanti region of Ghana, has more.
In Eastern and Southern Africa, 37 million children were out of school before the COVID-19 pandemic. 127 million left school when the pandemic hit. This led to a total of 164 million children in the region who have been out of school during the pandemic. The numbers are high in other parts of the continent as well. For example, 128 million students in Western Central Africa have been affected by closures from preschools to secondary schools. Abiyan Rana is UNICEF Regional Education Advisor for Eastern and Southern Africa. He says countries should explore various ways to compensate for learning loss by these children.
Now, we will have to put in place strategies in countries that are contextually appropriate in trying to ensure different methods are put in place so that children can start catching up on their learning loss. It could be through accelerated programs, it could be through remedial education, it could be through teaching at the right level. So there are various different ways we can try and approach this issue of learning loss.
He says UNICEF and its partners closed down their digital channels for 18 hours last week to signify at least 18 months of lost learning among students. Rana described the opportunities lost by these children by not being in school as a big crisis. He says many adolescent girls out of school were faced with early marriage, teenage pregnancies, child abuse at home, and many of them have lost out on the quality meals they used to get in schools.
They have lost out on their social interaction with other children. They have lost out on the health care that they got in school, the water sanitation support that they had in school. So many things in addition to the learning loss has happened to those children because of school closure for so long.
Rana says although remote learning has been introduced to replace instructions in closed schools, many children and communities do not have access to internet connectivity. He says internet connectivity is low and limited to mostly urban areas. He cites an example in Kenya, where 2 out of 10 students, or 20% of student population, are rich with remote learning.
But despite all of that, countries did opt for, you know, some in some case no tech, in some case low tech, in some case high tech solutions in trying to reach the children. So reach through television was much higher, reach through radio was much higher, but there was challenges around sustaining that reach for long periods. And when we're talking long periods of 18 months, it is a huge, huge challenge to continue and sustain remote learning. But this is something all countries are working on and trying to improve so that somehow similar circumstances arose, they would be able to reach their children more easily.
Rana says some, but not all, schools across Southern and Eastern Africa are trying to reopen. For example, those in Mozambique are partly closed, with pre-primary level students yet to be back in school. Schools remain shut in Uganda, where authorities say they want to protect children from the spread of the virus. He says, however, that evidence from other countries show that children are not the drivers of the COVID-19 pandemic. He says children are safer in schools than at home, where they can mingle among communities and risk a greater chance of catching the virus. Rana urges government, local authorities, and school administrations to reopen schools while taking needed steps to curb the transmission of the virus. He says schools should be the last to close and the first to be opened. Reporting for VOA, this is Mary Sorcery in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Defense Minister Yassin Ibrahim says the situation in the Sudanese capital is under control today, a day after officials said they had foiled an attempted coup. Ibrahim said the coup attempt was led by Major General Abdul Baghi al-Hassan Osman Bakrawi, along with 22 officers of different ranks and a number of non-commissioned officers and soldiers. Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok blamed remnants of Bashir's government for the coup attempt, describing it as an effort to undermine Sudan's democratic transition. The United Nations, African Union, the U.S., Great Britain, and other foreign governments condemned any attempts to interrupt the transitional period in Sudan through military means. Two grenade attacks were reported in the central part of Bujumbura last night, killing two people and injuring about 100. The Ministries of Security and the Interior told news conference and the government will pay medical fees for the injured. This is the second grenade attack in Burundi in two consecutive days. I spoke with our colleague, Frederick Inudikisha, managing editor of VOA Central African Service, about the attacks.
What is happening or what happened yesterday in Bujumbura, Frederick?
There were reports of grenade attacks in the economic capital of Burundi, Bujumbura, towards the evening. The first grenade attack occurred around 6 p.m. and the second grenade attack occurred around 8 p.m. No one has claimed responsibility, but the government of Burundi has confirmed two people died in the attacks, and 102 people were wounded.
Wow, that's a lot of people. And the same thing happened last Saturday, too. There was an attack close to the airport in Bujumbura. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes, indeed. There was an attack hours before President Evariste Ndayishimiye flew to New York to attend the UN General Assembly. Mm. And the rebel that carried out the attack and that claimed it is known by the name of Red Tabara. And it's a rebel group that allegedly carries attacks from a neighbor country, DRC, in Congo.
They're based in the Congo?
They are based in DRC, Congo, yes. And they actually claimed that they had launched an attack at the airport of Bujumbura.
Do they have any connections to the previous president in Nkurunziza?
They don't. Actually, it's a rebel group that started carrying attacks after there was a political crisis in Burundi in 2015 when late President Pierre Nkurunziza was trying to seek another term that some in the opposition termed as illegal term, while pro-government politicians said it was a legitimate term because they said it was a second term, while others were referring to it as a third and illegal term that violates the constitution.
So Burundi's government now has vowed actually a thorough investigation into these deadly attacks. What do you think this investigation will come up with?
According to reports that we have, some people have been already arrested. A few people tied with the grenades attacks 2 days ago. But also the prime minister today went to visit the wounded and vowed to punish whoever had carried out those attacks. And he said actually he referred them as terrorists, which means the government is seriously considering to really go after the rebels.
That was Frederick Inebukisha, managing editor of VOA Central African Service, speaking with me. Abdelkader Ben Salah, the veteran politician who replaced Algerian President Abdelaziz Bouteflika when he was forced to resign in 2019, died today at age 79. His death comes days after that of Bouteflika, who died last Friday at age 84. The army forced Bouteflika to resign in 2019. According to the French news agency AFP, the constitution called for Ben Salah, as Speaker of the House of Parliament, to become interim president. But his close relations with Bouteflika led thousands of protesters to oppose his elevation to the top job. Former South African President Jacob Zuma's corruption trial finally kicked off yesterday with a flurry of legal quibblings, but without the former leader, who remains hospitalized for an undisclosed ailment. The proceedings started with a heated argument over Zuma's medical records, with the prosecution demanding they be handed in as evidence on whether he really isn't fit to stand trial. Zuma also wants the lead prosecutor removed, accusing him of bias, but the prosecution insists he is going nowhere. Tosa Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The reason why Zuma did not attend the first day of the long-awaited trial at the Pietermaritzburg High Court in KwaZulu-Natal province became a point of contention between the prosecution and his defense. State prosecutor advocate Win Trengrove told the court his officers subpoenaed the Commissioner of Correctional Services, who granted Zuma medical parole in connection with his 15-month sentence for contempt of court, and Zuma's military doctors to testify on his fitness to stand trial.
They have placed him in what they regard as secondary medical care. Due to the advice of his doctors, he will remain in Gauteng to be within their reach. What does that mean? What is wrong with him and why isn't he here? That is certainly a dispute between the parties when the NPA doctors say, on the information you have given me, he seems fit to stand trial.
But Zuma's lawyer, Dali Mpofu, objected to Zuma's medical records being handed over to the court, insisting it was irrelevant as Zuma has resolved to get the corruption case started without being in the courtroom.
No, my lord. With the greatest respect, if it was your medical records or my medical records, I would not want them to be flying around.
No, they're not. But they're not going to fly around, Mr.
Well, my lord, with the greatest respect, we're dealing with somebody's medical records here. I think let's at least be sensitive. I know there are time issues, but let's not. We cannot bulldoze this issue. I'm sorry.
Finally, the judge dismissed the witnesses that included Zuma's doctors from the military and ordered that the trial proceed without Zuma in the court. Zuma's legal team argued to have lead prosecutor Billy Downer removed from the case, accusing him of displaying personal interest in the case, which has been dragging on for over a decade. Zuma is accusing Downer of leaking documents with his confidential health information to a journalist. He also says Downer gave a public lecture on the case, something that disqualifies him since he expressed his personal opinion, including criticism of the 2009 decision to drop charges against Zuma. Ahead of the trial's resumption, Zuma, through his Jacob Zuma Foundation, issued a harsh statement claiming that South Africa was changing from a constitutional democracy to dictatorship and that laws were being bent to deal with him. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Bees are believed to have killed 65 adult penguins at Boulders Beach near Cape Town. And South African rangers say they are searching for chicks that may have been orphaned. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to the clinical veterinarian, Dr. David Roberts, for the Southern Africa Foundation for the Conservation of Coast Birds, also known as SANCOB.
Roberts says the rangers have already found one penguin chick.
It was wandering around outside the nest and would have died. So he's being looked after, and if there are any more, then the rangers will bring them to us. We raise them, rehabilitate them, and then release them back into the wild.
He says he was informed about the 65 dead penguins on Friday. Rangers collected the bodies and took them to SANCOB, where they performed a post-mortem investigation.
So at first, we were very confused about what happened. And it took us a full day before we really realized that the cause of death was stings from bees. And the next day, we were able to identify the bees as Cape honeybees.
Roberts explains that since these bees usually die after stinging, he and his colleagues looked for dead bees in the sand at Boulders Beach Penguin Colony and found many. He says the penguins didn't stand a chance. A large number were stung over 20 times.
This high number of stings and the massive toxin load that would have led to their deaths. If anyone has been stung by a bee, they'll know how painful that is. 27 stings in an animal that only weighs 3 kilograms is very likely to be lethal.
Robert says while bees attacking birds when they feel threatened is not unheard of, it is unusual.
We think that it's likely that a nest of bees was disturbed, probably by people. It may have been totally unintentional. I don't think it was any malicious intent. We're not really worried about this being a big threat to the penguins.
However, he says the loss of even one penguin is tragic.
They're in danger of extinction, and every year the numbers are declining. For example, in the last 20 years, we've lost 40,000 pairs of African penguins. So we count penguins in pairs, that's the mother and father that raise chicks. And there are only just over 10,000 breeding pairs left.
Robert says he will be writing a scientific paper on this incident. Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
The UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization has named Accra, the capital of Ghana, as UNESCO World Book Capital of 2023. Cities designated as UNESCO World Book Capitals undertake to promote reading for all ages and population groups within and across national borders and organize a program of activities for the year. According to a UNESCO statement after Guadalajara, Mexico in 2022, Accra was selected because of its strong focus on young people and their potential to contribute to Ghana's culture and wealth. Accra's proposed program seeks to use the power of books to engage young people as an effective way of building skills for the next generation. Others designated UNESCO World Book Capitals over the years include Tbilisi, Madrid, Alexandria, New Delhi, Montreal, Turin, Bogota, Amsterdam, Beirut, Buenos Aires, Port Harcourt, Conakry, Athens, and Kuala Lumpur. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.